Welcome to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.
Welcome back. You're listening to America This Week. I'm Carrie Weber, Executive Editor at America, and I'm joined today by Father Matt Malone, our Editor-in-Chief, and Jim Keane, one of our Senior Editors. And we have with us today Christoria Welland, Dr. Christoria Welland. She's a clinical psychologist in San Diego. In 2015, she founded Pax in Familia, which is an international organization to improve pastoral responses to violence in Catholic families. And she's also the author of How We Can Help to End Violence in Catholic Families, a guide for clergy, religious, and laity. And she works in her role with both survivors and perpetrators of domestic violence, which I'm sure provides her with a number of interesting perspectives on the issue. And appropriately enough, we're talking about this today on the International Day of the Girl, which is the UN day in which the Vatican's recently has spoken out about this, about young women not necessarily being able to live up to their full potential in a lot of developing countries because of the abuse that they might have, or the lack of education or lack of resources. And I think it's easy to think about issues like that affecting only women sort of maybe in other places. But Dr. Christoria Welland makes it very clear that there are many struggles faced by women, and in particular women in this particular circumstance here in our country today. Dr. Christoria Welland, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate you asking me to be on.
We're very glad to have you. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit first about how you became involved in being in this issue.
You know, when I was in my 20s, I worked in Mexico City, and I visited a lot of families as part of my job as a catechist, and I came across so much domestic violence, you know, what is officially called intimate partner violence. I just came across so much literally every single day. And the rate in the areas that I visited was way higher than what you would see on a survey that was done in the entire country. So, I mean, it was probably well over 50%, versus in Mexico they say it's 35% to 40%. So it was very, very widespread in the areas that I visited, and it really, really struck me. And of course, I was visiting Catholic families, and you know, I have to say I was completely amazed. I just didn't realize that this could happen in a family that had supposedly given themselves to God and made their vows before Him on the altar. And so it was just very, very difficult for me to wrap my head around, but I was faced with this reality, and I moved from there.
Oh, wow. That must have been a really powerful and somewhat disheartening experience, but you were able to kind of channel that into action. Can you tell us about how you made that transition?
Yeah, you'll have to read my autobiography, which I haven't written yet. But honestly, I think that the main issue is either you sit there and stare at, you know, the blood and the broken bones and the sadness and the grief and the disbelief and all of those things, or you get out there and figure out how to make a little difference in it. And so when I went back to school and got my doctoral degree, I specialized in domestic violence, and I found that the programs that they were using here, because I was also working in the field at the same time, were not appropriate for Latino culture. So then I made that the topic of my doctoral dissertation. I did a research study. I did a pilot study. We wrote this program together, basically my Mexican clients and myself. And so I've been teaching that for the last 20 years or so in Latin America. And here in the United States, it's also widely used. So, but I mean, that's not the whole answer. You know, the whole answer would be much longer, so I'm not quite sure how much to talk.
Dr. Welland, if I could ask you a question about your piece, Caring for the Most Vulnerable, Undocumented Women in Abusive Relationships, at AmericanMagazine.org. You tell the story of the difficulty that some women face in the United States who are undocumented, who want to go to the police to report abuse, but in some circumstances face the awful choice whereby they may be turned over to immigration authorities if they do.
Right. And I mean, of course, it's been in place for a long time that if they call the police, they still face the possibility that the perpetrator will be arrested and deported. There's a pretty good chance that he'll be arrested, even whether or not he's documented. But if he's undocumented, I would say about in the last 2011 was the first time I heard it, that undocumented perpetrators are being deported, you know, right back to their country. And so as a result, that I'm sure has stopped many, many thousands, if not tens of thousands of women from making that report in the first place. Now it's moved into, since January of this year, that women, victims themselves are afraid to call in to get protection for themselves because they're not sure if they're going to be picked up at the courtroom, at the police station, by ICE and deported themselves. And so that's had a really chilling effect on people calling in and trying to get help for themselves.
And so we see, Doctor, how these issues are so interconnected. You know, how the work of social justice is, involves really a tapestry of issues that touch on one another in really dramatic and deep ways. And one of the things that I thought was interesting also about your piece was, you know, speaking of those interconnections, that October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month, and it's also a Right to Life Month. And you talk about in this piece how those two things come together. And I wonder if you might share a bit of that with our listeners.
Yeah, I'd very much like to talk about that. I think that I've been very involved in the pro-life movement for probably 35 years, and so I'm very familiar with, you know, the importance of that issue. I think that many people perhaps are not aware of how violence and, you know, all these sins against the Fifth Commandment, if you want to put it that way, hurting other people is also a violation against the right to life and the right to happiness and well-being. And especially if it's your spouse and you got married and you supposedly had all this instruction about, you know, what it means to be Christian spouses or Catholic spouses, and yet the whole thing still, it can fall apart and descend into violence. And this is something that happens with such great frequency. I mean, the numbers are not at all encouraging. And so I think it is very important to see this as a life issue. And in fact, the USCCB has it on their website under one of their pro-life issues. So I think it's really important to recognize this, that we have to protect life. We have to protect life in the womb. We have to protect life, you know, the life of children who are exposed to this kind of issues, plus to child abuse, which is a separate issue. And, of course, we have to protect victims. And in a sense, you know, we're just talking about the death penalty. I was listening. You also, as Catholics, we're also called to talk to the perpetrators, to work with the perpetrators, to bring them to a state of reconciliation, whether or not that means they're ever going to be with their partner again, because I don't advocate that in many cases.
Right.
But certainly everybody falls under the blanket of the mercy of God. You know, there's nobody left out of that.
Can you tell us a little bit about how you sort of moved into working with perpetrators in this field?
Yes, I'd be happy to share that with you. I started working with victims back when I was in Mexico City. That would have been the 1970s, so around 40-something years ago. And when I moved to San Diego in 1989, I went back to school and I got my doctoral degree. And as part of my training, I needed a job, so I got a job as a part-time therapist for Latino perpetrators of domestic violence who'd been arrested and sent to their 1 year of treatment, which is mandated by the courts. And I was put in there with this, basically with an English book called The Duluth Model, and said, you know, they told me just translate it as you go, and this is what you're going to use. At that time, it was mandated by the local council that we had to use that program. And just right away, it became clear to me that was not the appropriate program for them. It just it didn't resonate culturally. People were just staring at me like, "What are you talking about?" And so, as I said, I made that the work. My doctoral work was to come up with a program that would be culturally appropriate for them. And I didn't go into that job with very much enthusiasm. You know, when you've worked with victims at that time, it was maybe 20 something years. You know, you take kind of a dim view of abusers. It's pretty difficult to feel empathy or to you know, want to be around them. And right. so it was really hard for me, but I you know, they were begging me to take this thing because I speak Spanish and they were having trouble finding a therapist. And so I said, oh, all right, I'll go and try it. And, you know, it really became like a moment of revelation for me because suddenly the stereotypes were falling away, the stereotypes that I had built up in my own mind, and of course they also exist in most cultures of, you know, what a man who's violent to his partner looks like or behaves like. And it became a really important thing for my own development as a human being, as a Christian, to be able to see these men as human beings and to be able to work with them from that level, from the level of, you know, you're working with Christ here. It's not just, you know, a bad man. You're working with Christ in his distressing disguise, Christ who is wounded. And most of these guys are victims themselves, which doesn't justify their behavior, but it certainly changes how you work with them.
Right. Have you received any...
Yeah, it's...
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Have you received any criticism for doing that work?
Well, I don't get so much criticism here because it's, you know, it's mandated by courts all over the United States that mm-hmm. that perpetrators would be sent to therapy. So it's kind of understood that this is what you have to do. It's not mandated in most other places, for example, in Latin America, where I do a lot of my teaching. And so sometimes I get a lot of pushback mm-hmm. from people in the audience who believe that it's a waste of time, that it's useless, that it's unproductive, that it's ineffective to work with perpetrators. And I mean, there's, you know, so many caveats. This is a very big topic. So, you know, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. It depends on the personality type of the abuser. And, you know, just off the top of my head, because right now we're working on a research study that I haven't been able to get funded for a long time, but now it is. So, you know, I can't tell you with any kind of certainty exactly how many of them succeed in their program. I would say it's probably in the area of 60 to 75%, which is a lot. For therapy, you know, that's pretty good. But then there's going to be a certain number who have antisocial traits, who really, truly lack empathy right to the depth of their being and are just not interested in changing. And with those people, I don't think any therapy would work for them.
Right. Well, I imagine so, that therapy also helps the victims or potential victims, because I'm sure it can be hard for the partners to leave the abusive relationship or the abusive partnership. So you're in this way addressing it from both sides and possibly increasing the chance that someone would be safer in the future.
Yeah, and I mean, that really is the goal. And I'm very glad you mentioned that, because actually part of the reason why I began to be happy working with perpetrators is that, in fact, you have a much higher chance of things actually changing in the family than if you're working with a victim who doesn't have the power to make the changes. And so, you know, her only choice is often leaving the perpetrator, but there's so many complications associated with that. You know, obviously very big financial complications, which, you know, which often keeps people in their relationship. They just can't provide for their children, and so they stay there. And so from my standpoint, if I was able as a therapist and as a Catholic, as a catechist, to help people to change their behavior and to understand why they're changing it and, you know, the repercussions of not changing it, if we can get to that place, then you can really see change in a family.
Well,
and if you can't, then we stick with, okay, you're going to have, you know, someone has to leave here because it's just too dangerous to be here.
Because in a sense, you're talking about conversion, right? It's a change of, you know, not necessarily in a consciously theological sense, but it's a change of heart and mind and soul, really, to apprehend a new reality.
Yeah. Actually, that's absolutely true, Father. And you know, strangely enough, and I published an article about this a few years ago. I called up one of my patients who was a volunteer. I mean, you know, he wanted to be in therapy, and he came in, and it was one-on-one. Usually I do group therapy. But he'd had a tremendous difficulty with violence from his own childhood, and then that washed over into his relationship, and lots of infidelity and just tons of problems. And he was his wife was leaving him when he first came in, and she ended up leaving him, and I fully understand why. But our therapy lasted for quite a long time, and I thought when I was doing a case study that I would call him back and see how things were going. So I called him back probably maybe 4 or 5 years after we ended our therapy together. And he was in a new relationship. He had started going to church all the time. He had, you know, really come close to God. He was involved in retreats. And when I asked him, "Have you been violent to your partner?" He literally burst out laughing, like, "That's impossible. That couldn't." I mean, of course, you know, he knew it's not impossible. I mean, old patterns can always come back, right?
Right.
But you know, it was so foreign to the way that he was thinking. And you know, it really is true. You have to change your mind. You have to let, you know, the Word of God penetrate into the depths of your wounded spirit and change you. And yet, you know, that's not enough. I mean, I don't just say, "Well, you know, you need to go and pray." I mean, like, people who have problems with exercising violence, they need to learn very specific strategies to help them out of those danger spots. And of course, you know, A, they have to want to. They have to be motivated. And, you know, I find it to be much more effective if they're also on a spiritual journey while they're doing that. Hmm. But they still need to learn the psychological fine points of how to manage the rage that they feel, the out-of-controlness that they feel. I don't think that's a word.
I can go into this for hours, right?
It's a big topic.
Dr. Welland, we ran a story in AmericaMagazine.org last month by a writer named Tim Price about his own misgivings that he felt that the title was, "Can I Be a Good Husband and Father If My Own Dad Wasn't?" And I was reminded of it just now when you mentioned the cycles that this goes through, is that many abusers were themselves abused, and so the sins of the father are revisited on the son, and so on, and then obviously go out and result in other victims.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yeah. I mean, I mentioned that you might, with people, you know, with men who have, you know, grown up in those abusive situations, and that's not an uncommon fear, right?
No, it's not. Actually, I've had several men in my groups because, you know, we talk about these issues in some depth. I have a year with them, which is really great, even though I no longer do the groups because I teach. But quite a lot of the men in my groups have said that they made the decision when they were children that they would never treat their wife like that, that they'd never treat their children like that. And they sometimes have to get up and leave because they want to start crying when they start talking about this. It affects them so deeply because here they are, they made that decision. It was almost like a vow, you know, "I'll never do this." And then under duress, they find themselves doing it.
Hmm.
Or perhaps under the influence of alcohol or both. And so, you know, they break their vow. They're tremendously disappointed with themselves. And they start feeling really desperate. It's like, you know, "I don't want to do this and I'm doing it." I mean, doesn't it sound a lot like the letter to the Romans?
Yeah, it sure does.
So there's this, you know, there's this suffering that we go through as human beings. "I don't want to do this, but I'm doing it." And, you know, there's been a lot of research in the last decade or so on the effects of trauma on a person's neurobiology. So our actual brain changes as a result of trauma. And so this is not something that is, you know, to be lightly approached. I mean, it takes time. It takes a lot of work. It's not always effective, or somebody might find themselves falling back into that old pattern because it's literally engraved into their brain. And these, you know, these tremendously deep and out-of-control emotions get called up, and unless they have, you know, a bunch of strategies that they can pull from, we call them the toolbox, right? A bunch of different categories of behavior that they can draw from when needed, depending on the situation, it would be so easy for them to get sucked back into that emotional trauma part of their brain where they literally just don't know what to do other than what they've always done or what was always done to them. So it's very tragic, and we have so much work to do in this field.
Right. And well, one person who addressed it in Amoris Laetitia is Pope Francis, talking about this fact that, you know, he says, I think particularly of the shameful ill treatment to which women are sometimes subjected, domestic violence and various forms of enslavement. And I wonder what you thought when you saw this specifically brought out as an issue in the Pope's writings.
Well, first of all, why don't we ask what I felt? I mean, I was jumping up and down in front of my computer when I, because, of course, I was, you know, waiting anxiously for the document to come out. I mean, this is partly because in 2014 and 2015, I pretty much plagued anybody that I was able to get an ear at the Vatican to bring this up at the Synod on the Families. And I had the help of Archbishop Cordiglione to make some inroads there. And as a result, I was invited to speak at the World Meeting of Families. And that was great, because that topic had never been brought up. So now this is 2015. So, you know, I took copies of my book in six languages to Rome with my husband, and we dropped them off at the audience hall where the fathers and participants of the synod were sitting. I saw them with my own eyes, put them into their slots, you know, everybody's slots. So everybody got a copy of this book. And if I made it purposely very short and illustrated and easy to read so that they would just pick it up and start leafing through it and just say, oh, you know, this is not a huge tome. I can probably read this. And so the thought that, and I'm not saying that because they read my book, that's why that's in Amoris Laetitia.
Well, but it sounds like it's an actual real possibility, though. That's
great. I would like
great.
To believe that yeah. it had something to do with it, because actually I sent four packages of my book. So there's nine editions of the book in different languages and illustrations. I sent four of those packages to different parts of the world, wherever the Holy Father was visiting.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm sure they're just fed up with me, but I figured... You know, I mean, it doesn't matter if they're fed up with me. This isn't about me. This is about, you know, the literally millions of Catholic families that are affected by this plague. And so I thought, you know, now's the chance. Now's the opportunity. And so, you know, when I saw how clearly the Holy Father brought this up, and it's not just in that quote that you just read, which is great. There's many other areas where he talks about sexual violence. He talks about sometimes you have to separate. Sometimes, you know, you can't live like this. And this is about your own self-respect. He talks about many things that have to do with violence in that document in ways that have never been spelled out that clearly in a papal document. And trust me, I know, because I'm constantly going through these
right.
things to try to find something to quote.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, it really disappointed me when I first wrote my program in 2001. I was, you know, I put in a section on like religion and domestic violence, and you know, how can our faith help us to prevent us to be violent? And
right.
I couldn't find any references that were really, really clear, and I haven't been able to, you know, until this papacy. And so, naturally, all of us who work in this field are just absolutely ecstatic about the Holy Father's clarity.
Yeah,
and you know how he's really, really bringing this up, and he's saying, okay, this is wrong. Don't do this.
Right.
In very clear ways.
That's exactly right. Dr. Welland, thank you so much for being with us. And just as Pope Francis said today, we might need to revise the Catechism. Now you might need to revise your book in light of the fact that what the Pope has said. Thank you very much for being with us.
And
for
your my book has been revised.
Oh, it has?
On
okay.
my website. Yes, I put up the second edition, which has many quotes from the Holy Father's document on it.
Oh, fantastic. Good.
Yeah, it's already done.
Well, good. Then people should pick it up. thank you so much for being with us, Dr. Welland, and thank you for your contribution to America.
Thank you very much. It was a great pleasure.
Okay. The piece is called Caring for the Most Vulnerable Undocumented Women in Abusive Relationships by Christoria Welland, and you can find that at americamagazine.org. That's a really a remarkable story.
Indeed. Yeah. What a wonderful woman.
Yeah. And doing amazing work. A very good example of bringing your faith into a work that, you know, needs the grace of God. So, you've been listening to America This Week on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Be sure to check us out for more information about all the topics we covered today at americamagazine.org. And to subscribe to America, you can call 1-800-627-9533. That's 1-800-627-9533 for a smart Catholic take on faith and culture. For Jim Keane and Carrie Weber, I'm Father Matt Malone. Thank you and good day.
Thank you for listening to the podcast of America This Week, courtesy of the Catholic Channel on Sirius XM 129. If you want to listen to more, subscribe to Sirius XM and tune in on Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129.